without that, please.
Yeah. So thanks. It's nice to be here. So I am definitely an experimentalist, and I'm going to be telling you about some work in my lab here at UCSB, which focuses on the interaction of single spins in diamond with mechanical resonators, eventually pushing towards the regime of coupling between single spins and single phonons and what one could engineer with that kind of quantum coherent interaction. Actually, the NV center is the spin that we are currently looking at. I will just say at the outset that there are other spins in other materials and also in diamond that could be interesting in, for these types of applications, but right now we're mostly focused on the NV center. And this is really the workhorse. This spin system is the workhorse of our lab. It has some quantum properties that are uniquely accessible at room temperature and just a very easily accessible way. For instance, they exhibit very long quantum coherence times at room temperature. One can use simple optical microscopes to address them. So for an experimentalist, they're a very attractive system to work with. And moreover, they're very sensitive to a wide variety of fields, electric fields, thermal fields, magnetic fields, strain fields. And because they're sensitive to these different fields, they can be used to either sense these fields or they can be used to sort of couple to other degrees of freedom because of their sensitivity. So that's my brief introduction to ANV. Let me tell you a little bit about what it is. It's a defect in the diamond lattice where there's two carbon atoms replaced by nitrogen in a neighboring vacancy. And these can be formed naturally. They do occur naturally. We actually do something a little bit unique here, is that we grow our own diamond and we introduce nitrogen during the growth and we form our vacancies via electron irradiation, maybe something I'll get to later. But the point is that we have a very sort of controlled way of introducing NV centers, and I'll show you later how we can even put them basically kind of exactly where we want them while maintaining their excellent quantum coherence properties. So that's something that's a little bit unique to us. So this defect center is like a little artificial atom. It has an optical transition. So there's a ground state and an excited state, which are split by about 637 nanometers light. So it's effectively naturally coupled to photons, which is nice. And this ground state actually turns out to be a spin triplet, and one can sort of treat two of these spin triplet states in the ground state. And this is the highly coherent spin that the NV center is well known for. At zero magnetic field, there's about a 3 gigahertz splitting, which is also sort of convenient. So there's a lot of convenience here, as I said. One can easily drive spin rotations with, you know, gigahertz scale microwaves. One can optically interrogate this spin. And as I'd like to say, it sort of marries the benefits of solid-state physics and atomic physics. So it's sort of like in a little atom. It's highly coherent, but it's housed in a solid-state matrix, so we don't have to go through a lot of rigmarole to trap it, et cetera. It's there, and it stays there forever. Of course, it's not a perfect atom because it does live in a lattice, and because of that, it interacts with local phonons and strain. And so we'll see this later through the talk, but everyone's a little bit different, unlike real atoms. And everyone by itself maybe exhibits a little bit more spectral diffusion. For instance, the photons that are emitted are not always the exact same frequency. But we'll get through that later. And by the way, please ask a lot of questions because I'd rather that.
So how big is the lattice? The diamond lattice.
How big?
Yeah, how big is the size?
Oh, you mean what's the lattice spacing?
No, not the size. The
actual, how big is the piece of diamond that we use?
So in terms of lattice size, how many sizes do you have?
So a few millimeters on
a
side.
Much bigger than the coadjutant system.
Yeah, right. So we have like chunks of diamond, which are, you know, a few millimeters on a side. Actually, in the end, you'll see that we're trying to get to the regime where we're coupling NV centers to sort of single phonons. For that, we then structure the lattice down to make very small, say, cavities, optical cavities or mechanical cavities. And then those are on the orders of hundreds of nanometers. But we start with a really very macroscopic piece. And there's, you know, millions of NV centers inside, but we can easily find individual ones and address them optically with light.
Can you comment what is the meaning of these arrows?
These arrows?
Yes.
Sorry, this is just, I am saying that this ground state spin triplet, if you choose two of those levels, can be just represented as a canonical spin. So you can call this spin up and spin down. It's just a two-level system.
But one of them is doubly degenerate.
Yeah. So what is the? It's a spin triplet. So the three states are the ms equals 0, ms equals plus and minus 1 projections of the spin triplet. And at zero magnetic field, yes, the plus and minus 1 are degenerate in the absence of any strain or electric field. But generally, there is some strain. So in fact, you have sort of three levels, and you can choose any of those two to be a triplet, and then you can call those. I'm just calling them up and down to say that it's.
You distinguish projections. What is the
axis? So it's the NV axis. So it's the axis between the N and the V. So that sets the Z axis, the crystal axis.
Nuclear spins goes.
So there is a nuclear spin on the nitrogen. And in fact, each of these is already has a hyperfine splitting. Well, the plus, the zero state doesn't.
Which is not indicated.
Which is not indicated here, no. But this is just very simplistic. One can basically take any of the, now, you know, five levels in the ground state, which are the hyper. Well, it depends if it's nitrogen 14 or 15, then you have three hyperfine or two. But you can take sort of any of those two levels and call them your spin.
Okay, which projection is, which of these levels is twice degenerate?
So the ms equals plus 1 and minus 1.
Yeah, but is it up or down?
Oh, actually, I'm saying that you can, so maybe I should have been a little bit more correct in there. I'm saying you could choose this to be the 0 and this to be the plus 1. You could choose this to be the 0 or this to be the minus 1. You could choose this to be the plus 1 and this to be the minus 1. So really, you could do any of those. And all of those, depending on what you want to do and how you want to manipulate. So let's say you want to manipulate with microwave magnetic fields, then you would use the 0 and the plus 1 because those couple to microwave magnetic fields. Let's say you wanted to use electric fields or strain fields, then you might want to use the plus and minus 1 as your spin triplet. And they're all just coherent.
Just a simple question. This is a ground state, yes?
These
two levels are the ones, they are ground states. So
they're the ground state, yes.
Ground state. In the ground state, in the absence of any external field, which level corresponds to the twice double degenerate?
So maybe I'll say this one.
This one.
Typically, these NV centers don't interact. Two NV centers in the diamond don't interact because they're far enough away in the crystal.
Typically, that's the truth. So magnetic dipolar interactions, in order for those, right. I mean, so in order for the magnetic dipolar interactions to couple two NV centers, they have to be about 10 nanometers apart from each other to strongly couple them. And generally, they're not that close. People have seen them that close. But it's sort of it's not often seen.
Because they can much more efficiently interact by a cavity. But then it's probably they're not resonant. I mean, you don't have two which are resonant.
Right. So, and that's actually something I will address. That yes, you can match them with the cavity, but they have to be the same. And so, how do you get them to be the same? And actually, we can show that we can do that with strain. Actually, as one. Application. They will electrically uncouple because they're charged. But okay, so to kind of give a brief summary of sort of why there's a lot of interest in NV centers in general, recently in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, is they're interesting for quantum devices because of their very long spin coherence time. So if we talk about that ground state spin, it can have spin coherence times on the order of several milliseconds at room temperature, which is pretty unique for a solid state spin system, given that it's housed inside, you know, a lattice where you have lots of environmental, not a lot of control over your environment. Okay, it's a solid state system, so in principle it could be easily integrated into it could be scalable, I guess. And the spin, this ground state spin, can be optically initialized, so one can initialize it into the, say, the down state or the ms equals zero state just by shining light on it. One can engineer coherent control over the spin state with microwaves. Again, at this 3 gigahertz, relatively easily accessible microwave frequency. And also the spin state can be optically read out. So just by shining light on the NV and measuring the intensity of the fluorescence, I can determine which state it's in. So this is, again, this adds to the experimental ease of the system. And therefore, some of the applications are, because it's sensitive to magnetic fields and electric fields and thermal fields, but magnetometry, I think, is one of the big applications. I think that's really one of the, say, killer apps of the NV Center. As for quantum information processing, as a qubit, it has some promise, except there are some issues that have to be overcome. We'll talk about those. It's also a single photon source because it's individually addressable. They're used in biology as fluorescent biomarkers because they don't bleach. They emit photons and more photons and more photons, and they keep emitting photons for, you know, months as opposed to the current biomarkers, and also for other types of electric field, thermal field sensing. So, okay.
So you mentioned thermal fields more than once, and then to ask you, what's a thermal field?
So I shouldn't say a field. temperature, just temperature sensing. Sorry.
So what happens? How are they sensitive to temperature?
Effectively, because temperature will change the lattice constant. So in a way, it's very similar to strain, actually, sort of, you know, hydrostatic strain. And so let's say in the ground state, as the lattice expands, your spin-spin interaction between your two spins and your triplet changes.
You can actually detect that by looking.
Yes, and the energy levels in the ground state shift. And you can get up to millikelvin per root hertz temperature sensitivity, which is sort of better than for biology. People are excited because in biology you can't really do
it. And you see that by looking at the light emitted or the 2.8 gigahertz?
So actually you look at the light emitted. In the end you look at the light emitted, but the temperature changes the splitting of the ground state, but you monitor that. You monitor the ground state splitting optically. So it's optically detected magnetic resonance is what you do. So, as I said, the NV Center sort of forms the workhorse of my lab. We have three, I'd say, main thrusts. One of them is using the NV Center as a nanoscale sensor of magnetic fields for imaging. This is something that's maybe a little bit more applicable to the other KITV conference that's going on right now. But we are using this right now to image nanoscale magnetic fields in interesting condensed matter systems. Something that I'll talk about today, which hopefully has more relevance to your interest, is how we're using the spin to couple to eventually phonons, but right now to the strain induced by a mechanical resonator. Something that we have also been working on, but much more just in a way trying to understand the properties of the NV centers to see if we can make the NV center good enough for integration into sort of a optical circuit where we want to look at sort of spin-photon hybrid quantum systems, so couple the spin to photonic degree of freedom. And so, as I said, I'll mostly talk about this today just to advertise. I'm excited about this reason. We recently showed that we can actually image vortices in this case, an iron pnictide superconductor using NV center. So we're able to scan our NV center over superconductor and image the local magnetic field. So I think this is pretty exciting because one can do this with much better spatial resolution. We have about 6 nanometer spatial resolution, which is sort of better than any other state-of-the-art magnetic imaging technique. So did you have a question?
So, well, just for comparison, what can people do with squids?
So squids, I would say scanning squids in particular, because if one wants to image, you really have to be able to image. Scanning squids are generally much larger, on the order of micron scale spatial resolution, with the one exception of a recent nano squid developed in Israel in the Zeldov group, where they can get down to about 50 or 100 nanometer spatial resolution using scanning squids. But 50 nanometers is really about as small as they can get, and as we've demonstrated, 6. Really, we're going to be limited basically by how close we can bring our. It's a single atomic defect, and so spatial resolution will be limited by how close we can bring that defect to the sample, which can be on the order of a few nanometers.
So you said here it's 6 nanometers?
Here it's not 6. This one in particular is not 6 nanometers. We've imaged some hard drives where we see spatial features.
So what are these rings? Sorry.
So these are vortices. These are just vortices.
Right, they look like rings.
Why do they look like rings? Because this is also... So this is actually a contour image. So this is just a contour of a constant magnetic field. The way that we're taking this particular image is we're looking at when the magnetic field from the sample brings our NV center into resonance with an applied microwave field. So we're sort of doing a slight, so it's almost like, you know.
I see, so the magnetic field is largest in the middle and it folds off, and at some point it hits
At some point it hits a resonance, We can also do full field images, but this is just faster. And okay, but so we're excited about that. But I'll talk about this mostly today.
Do you use a single
NV center? Yes. Yes, we do. Okay, so why one might be interested in coupling spins to mechanics? So some reasons that we are interested in currently is mechanics give you an additional degree of control over the NV, I should probably not just say spin state, but over the NV spin properties and the optical properties. So for instance, the zero phonon line, the 637 nanometer wavelength of the light that's emitted by an NV center, can be influenced by local strain. And so if we can controllably apply strain, we can, say for instance, bring two NV centers that are initially off-resonant into resonance with each other. Okay. People have shown you can do this with electric fields in the past. Strain has an important advantage here. Electric fields, when you apply an electric field, yes, you tune your start shift, your NV center, but you also tend to disrupt or change the local electrostatic environment pretty heavily. And that tends to cause a lot of extra spectral diffusion of your NV center. So with strain, one, you don't cause as much disruption of the environment. Okay. Furthermore, in the ground state, I had this spin triplet. We can drive spin transitions, say, between the plus and minus one states of the spin triplet using, using say, AC strain fields, which one cannot do with AC magnetic fields because those don't couple minus one to plus one. Right? So that gives you some extra degrees of extra handles of control. Now there's some sort of Peter Rabel, who was here, and then he's gone now, but he has had some nice proposals where you could actually use phonons to mediate interactions between, say, two spins. So let's say I have two spins, and this is what Vadim was asking about earlier, you know, how do two spins interact? If they're not, you know, within 5 nanometers of each other, where they're naturally magnetically coupled, one can imagine coupling both of them to sort of a global mechanical mode. And mechanical modes have the nice advantage that they couple to a large number of fields and also are relatively delocalized and hence can couple distant things. And I know Ash also thinks about these things as well. And maybe also mediating sort of information between, say, the spin and the photon, because we know that we can couple. People have shown that they can sort of engineer quantum interactions between photons and mechanical resonators. Okay, but for any of these futuristic proposals to happen, one needs to have quantum control over the mechanical resonator, bring it to near its quantum ground state. And in fact, Peter Rabel and his co-workers have also proposed a way to actually use the NV center to exert quantum control over the mechanical resonator. So very similar to sort of laser cooling with atoms. There's some analogies in this paper too. So, and lastly, I'd say that just understanding the role of strain on the defect of the NV center, really we can learn a lot about some of the intersystem crossing, some of the atomic energy levels of the NV center, and the interaction of strain and phonons really plays an important role for NV centers as quantum memories in terms of their coherence, in terms of their in terms of our ability to read them out effectively. So just sort of understanding all the interactions of strain, and that's something I'll actually talk a fair amount about. Okay, so why are we doing this in diamond? There's a variety of experiments that have demonstrated coupling of spins to mechanics. Dan Ruger actually is probably one of the first people to do this in a very nice way. Actually, Dan Ruger is giving today's physics colloquium at 4 o'clock in Broida, so if anybody's interested. And so that was one of the original experiments where they showed that they can couple a single spin to a mechanical degree of freedom through a magnetic gradient interaction. Other work was sort of magnetic coupling of NV centers to mechanical resonators, quantum dots inside nanowires with a strain coupling. Here at UCSB2, there's been nice work coupling superconducting qubits to mechanical resonators, coupling atoms to the motion of a macroscopic mechanical resonator. Here's another quantum dot inside of a gallium arsenide resonator coupled to the mechanics. So there's a few implementation of these types of systems. Why are we doing this in diamond? Well, there's a few benefits. I already mentioned that the spin is very coherent in diamond at room temperature and also at low temperature. Furthermore, diamond itself has very low intrinsic mechanical dissipation, so its phonons are very long-lived. And actually, we showed this recently that we formed diamond single crystal diamond mechanical resonators with very high mechanical quality factors. Okay, so again, at room temperature and really just in our first try at doing this. And if we talk about strain coupling, if you have an NV center inside of a mechanical resonator, it's a very integrated monolithic platform. One doesn't need to sort of bring a spin close to, say, a magnetic field gradient and worry about positioning and worry about maybe the effects of magnetic noise from your magnet on the NV center, that sort of thing. It's already integrated. Okay, there's some challenges. Diamond fabrication is not so easy. We have now sort of, I'd say it was immature, we've now, I think, made great strides in this area. And also the interaction of the NV center with strain has not been well characterized, and this is something that we've done almost, I think, too carefully, but I'll talk about that some here. So this just shows an example that we can make basically very clean, nice mechanical resonators. These are just singly clamped beams. We are now working on making more sophisticated mechanical structures. I'll show you some pictures later. Okay, so how do we generate the coupling between the spin and the mechanics? Again, it's pretty simple. In this case, we form singly clamped diamond cantilevers. We put an NV at the base where the strain is, say, maximum. It doesn't have to be at the base, but it is maximized at the base. And we can control, we have a large amount of control over the interaction of strain. So with the NV, we can control the strain by the NV depth. Okay, so the nearer the NV is to the surface, the larger the strain. Also, we can control the amount of strain with the amplitude of bending. Also, we have four different possible orientations of the NV in the crystal lattice, in the diamond lattice. And so those four orientations will interact differently with sort of this first flexural mode. So in general, this is a highly controlled platform for strain studies. And so I've alluded to already the fact that there's this ground state spin. So here I write out ms equals 0, ms equals plus or minus 1. And there's also this sort of optical spin. There's this two-level system. And really, there's actually six excited states up here. But I'm going to, for most of this, focus on two states. This is an orbital doublet here. And strain actually splits the energies of these two orbital states in the excited state. Okay, so one might be interested in coupling strain to the excited state because, first of all, the strain coupling is much larger in the excited state. It shifts the red line much more than it shifts the splitting between these two. And the excited state is obviously useful for coupling to photons, so that's nice. And the proposals from, say, Peter Rabel invoke coupling, strain coupling to the excited state for generating, say, cooling of mechanical resonators. So that's why we're interested in characterizing and then using the strain coupling to the excited state. In the ground state, I already mentioned this has the long spin coherence time, which is used for storage. There's been proposals that one can engineer squeezing, a spin squeeze state amongst an ensemble of spins by coupling them to a phonon mode, for instance. But the strain coupling is pretty small in the ground state. It's more on the order of gigahertz, so it's about a million times smaller.
What's the natural frequency of these
mechanical resonators? So we can engineer that, basically. So we can engineer that just by...
Not up to gigahertz.
No, so you can't actually... We're now trying to make them in about the gigahertz scale.
Yeah, because I mean, the question is that here you're discussing coupling to strain, but you can also imagine just solid body rotations where the quantization, if the quantization axis wobbles,
yes,
you can excite states without making optical transitions, but you have to presumably match the 2.8 gigahertz.
Yeah, that's something that we, it's, right now we're trying to make gigahertz resonators more for actually this type of, but yes, there are, I think if you can match that, there's a lot that opens up. But it's not crazy to do that at lower frequencies because you can apply a magnetic field to split these,
yeah,
and then you can bring one and zero into much closer.
So these kinds of sort of a spin-only transitions or sort of, is that accessible?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. So first I'll talk about this briefly. Okay, so how does strain interact with the ground state? So strain is not a vector, but for simplicity, for this discussion, I'm just going to equate it to an electric field because it has some similarities to an electric field. And in fact, due to the symmetry of the NV center, it can effectively be cast into an effective electric field. So in the simple picture, what does strain do? So I'm writing epsilon as the strain, and I'm just saying that's the one that's parallel to the NV axis, so it's pulling the N and the V apart like a uniaxial strain in that direction. This would be the strain susceptibility, and this would be in the perpendicular direction, of course. And so now I'm really only characterizing by two parameters instead of three. But again, this is a very simplistic model. So if we show the ground state energy spin, the ground state spin, that's, again, the spin triplet, which in the presence of a small magnetic field, the plus and minus one are split in energy, okay, and then by the Zeeman effect. Now, in the presence of a strain field that's along the axis of the NV, that serves basically just to shift this effective zero field splitting, okay, so it shifts both of these energy levels together. And then a perpendicular strain field splits the plus and the minus one states, and it mixes them. So now it produces sort of new eigenstates that are mixtures of plus and minus one. And furthermore, the interaction of the spin with the NV center is suppressed by large magnetic fields. Okay, so it comes in quadratically with divided by this Zeeman splitting. So, okay, so that's how we can effectively discriminate the effects of parallel and perpendicular strain. If we define our spin qubit, so now as I said, you know, you can kind of define any of these, because now we have zero, minus, and plus, we can define any of those two levels to be our spin qubit. If we define the zero and the plus to be our spin qubit, the energy of this transition looks like this. Okay, so why is this? I'm showing this because if you now consider an AC strain, which is what we're going to be using, because we're going to be driving our cantilevers, and that produces an AC strain. Okay, so if we produce an AC strain field that modulates this qubit frequency at the cantilever's resonant frequency, whatever frequency you're driving. But you can see the perpendicular component modulates the splitting at twice the cantilever frequency. Okay, so we can use effectively lock-in amplifier techniques to spectroscopically differentiate between the parallel and the perpendicular components of the strain. So this exercise was meant at, first of all, showing that we can generate coherent interactions between strain and spin, but also we wanted to measure this parameter and this parameter, which had not been well characterized before.
And just to check, the modulation is it's going to be typically at a much lower frequency than this splitting.
Yes. Yeah. We use about a megahertz scale cantilevers. But I think that is interesting. I mean, that's interesting to get into the regime where they become closer. But
and how can you measure the amount of strain correctly?
So we know exactly how much stress we apply from the so we know how far we're bending the cantilever. Okay. Is this the question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we can calibrate.
You want to be sure that you know what epsilon is.
Exactly. Yeah. So we can monitor we know exactly the deflection of the cantilever, and then that gives us, So when we drive the cantilever, that presents a stress along this direction. And if you take a sort of cut along this plane that's sort of perpendicular to the cantilever axis, you can see that there's two classes of envies, the red class and the green class. So the green class feel a different direction of strain than the red class. Okay, so we use that effect to characterize the parallel and perpendicular strain. But also, getting back to your question of how do we know how much stress we're applying, well, we know what sigma is because we know how far we bend the cantilever. Of course, one might naively think, oh, well, these guys only experience a perpendicular strain. But really, there's the Poisson effect, which also tends to add some parallel strain to those red guys. So we have to sort of incorporate all of that.
You also mentioned earlier that depending on the depth of the
yes, and we know the depth, we have some error on our depth.
So is strain, no, I'm just imagining bending a stick.
Yeah.
Is there a formula for how strain
yes.
depends?
Yes, yeah. It basically goes linearly with depth, and right in the middle, there's gonna be some sort of neutral axis where there's no strain, because up here, it's like tensile strain, and down here, it's compressive strain. But somewhere here, there's no strain. So you don't want to be looking at envies that are in the center of the cantilever
right.
that have no strain. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Don't you have residual strain?
We do have residual strain, and that's important. It's probably important here too, but I think it's so small compared to the strain that we applied, it was not important. But actually, when I talk about the optical transitions, that was hugely important. And so.
Well, it's definitely important that you don't want many centers to be resonant.
Yeah, but we're only looking at one. The centers are very far apart, and we're only looking at one.
Okay, but I think we're only looking at one just because there is residual strain.
We only look at one because generally they're, I guess we always, we only look at one because it makes the interpretation of the data simpler, right? Because then we know exactly what its direction is. If we looked at many different ones, they have different directions, and you're just going to get basically inhomogeneous broadening. So. It makes it sort of simpler. Okay, so I won't go through all the sort of the way that we took the data, but the upshot is we could generate coherent spin rotations by strain, and we can measure it by using sort of Hahn echo techniques drawn from the NMR and ESR communities from say 50 years ago. So effectively, what you're seeing here is you're seeing the spin state of the NV center as a function of time being modulated by an AC strain field. Okay, and so the AC strain is coherently driving spin evolution. So if you're thinking of it in terms of the Bloch sphere, the NV center, we initialize it into sort of the XY plane on the Bloch sphere, and strain basically drives it around the Bloch sphere. Okay. And we can monitor its position on the Bloch sphere optically. And I think the short story is that we can fit this data to get these, knowing how much strain we're applying, how much stress we're applying, and comparing that to strain, we can extract D-parallel and D-perp with pretty good precision. So we've effectively measured these coupling constants very carefully. So that's the upshot of the strain measurement in the ground state.
So Anya, how different are these numbers from what was assumed in some of the theory proposals?
Yeah, so I'd say that this number is not too different. This perpendicular strain coupling number is not too different. And this number came from considering some measurements of the strain coupling in the excited state, and then just assuming that the effect in the ground state is just second order from this, you know, very far removed excited state. And they had sort of used the same theory to estimate what this number was going to be, and got this number to be like two orders of magnitude lower than what we measured. So that's kind of what was new, although I'd say that people just hadn't done a careful enough job, because people did see that with temperature, they saw that effectively this zero field splitting D does change. And in a way, one can model temperature as some kind of strain. So clearly, there was something that wasn't quite working, but nobody had really, I think, I don't know, been too careful with measuring that. And I think now that we've done these measurements. People have done some calculations of how do the spin-spin interactions change with strain and get numbers that are in this ballpark, actually.
The integration time limited by longitude?
Oh, yeah, so in terms of...
Why you limited that to 7 microseconds? Is it microseconds?
Oh, okay, so in this case, actually, there's, so our T2 in this case was quite a bit longer, but there was a, okay, so you know a little bit about NV center. So there's a magnetic field and one, there's some carbon 13, and there's carbon 13 precession, which gives you another sort of collapse and revival. And so we sort of are measuring within the first collapse of the carbon 13 interaction with the NV center. We could have certainly measured up to longer, but I mean, this gives us the fact that we're getting many oscillations in sort of one cantilever period tells us that we're driving the spin several times around the block sphere already. So we already have, you know, we have a strong enough signal. We don't really need to go out further.
Wouldn't have that increase the error in the precision of the D measurement? Would it be
sure, if we had gone out for, if it could have increased this. Yes.
Presumably you would have to fit another parameter. Is that right? If you discovered 13, does that bring sort of unknown parameters?
Yeah, but we just sort of phenomenologically model some. There's sort of a rough understanding of what the, depending on the density of carbon 13, but what the form of this sort of decay is.
So this time window is how many periods of the...
So the cantilever is oscillating at about a megahertz. And so basically, at one cantilever oscillation period, you get a full revival of the coherence. So this right. corresponds to one oscillation.
I got it.
Two
oh,
oscillations,
I got it.
Three yes. oscillations. Yes. And within each oscillation, these sort of fringes are showing that the spin is actually rotating many times around the block sphere. So, yeah, sorry, I didn't go through the details of the experiment because I didn't know if it would be too interesting, but I figured this was sort of maybe the main upshot. Another sort of nice thing, okay, that we can do is we can also, if one wants to image the strain, let's say you have a mechanical device and you're curious where the strain is maximum or what the strain profile looks like, we can do that. So effectively what we did here is we looked at NV centers, say here, 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 here. If we look from the side, we looked at these NV centers, we measured their strain their strain coupling as we drive the cantilever, and this shows what we measured as a function of distance from the base, and this follows the very expected mode of the first flexural mode of the cantilever. So, you know, if you drove this higher order modes, you would see sort of this go up and down. So this is what we expect, but it's also, I think it's a nice application because one could use NV centers to measure image strain on the nanoscale. Okay, so now I'll switch to the excited state. There's the clock. Okay. So how to strain coupled to the excited state? As I said, I'm going to simplify the excited state level structure of the NV center to just consider two orbital states, which I'll call the EX and the EY state. Okay. So if we do resonant photoluminescence excitation, we can sweep the frequency of our laser. When our laser is resonant with one of these transitions, we get a peak in emitted photons. Okay, so with that, we can spectroscopically monitor our EY and our EX states. And so intrinsic strain splits these two. At zero strain, those should be degenerate. Okay, so, and now I'm going to, those EX and EY states respond, are selectively excited by a linear polarization of in one direction, or in X, or the Y, or orthogonal linear polarizations. And so we can adjust the polarization of our excitation to only excite one of those, so EY. So now we're only sensitive to EY. And so without driving the cantilever, we get our optical line. Now we start driving the cantilever, and we get a splitting of this optical line. The reason it has this sort of Batman shape, it doesn't look like two well-resolved peaks at this point, is because we are actually monitoring the photoluminescence during the whole time that the cantilever is moving. So this is actually a Lorentzian line shape modulated by this sort of sinusoidal strain oscillation. So But we can fit this and extract, say, a strain coupling coefficient. Okay, this is a very simplistic one. Okay, as we drive the cantilever harder and harder, you can see that we can split this optical line more and more. I'll get into sort of more of the details of the analysis in a second. This just shows that this is a mechanical resonance phenomenon. So what I showed you on the previous plot was basically just a line cut, and we drive the cantilever on resonance. Before, I just showed you the EY state. This shows you the EY and the EX state. So on resonance, we get sort of a large splitting of our two lines. As we detune the mechanics from resonance, we see that our effective shifting, our effective coupling to that optical line reduces. Okay, and then it matches very well with our theory. Okay, so what can you do? One can measure how far these two peaks split as a function of applied strain. Fit a line, okay, you get a coupling coefficient of about 1 petahertz per strain. Okay. But this is very simplistic, but strain obviously is a tensor. So it's not the interaction of strain with the EnV center is not characterized by one parameter. It should be characterized by a strain tensor. And there could be 9 coupling coefficients, but because of the symmetry of the EnV center, and also because the EnV center doesn't care if you rotate the whole crystal, for instance, you can reduce your coupling parameters to 4. Okay, so the EnV strain coupling can be characterized by these 4 parameters: a lambda 1, a lambda 2, a lambda 3, and a lambda 4. And if you were to write out what the energies of your EX and EY states look like, they look like this. One can think of lambda 1 and lambda 2 as being the A1 symmetric coupling coefficients, meaning if I apply a strain that preserves the symmetry of the EnV center, so for instance, I just stretch it along the z-axis here. So if I just stretch along the z-axis, all the symmetries of my EnV are preserved, right? I still have all my C3V symmetries. I can still rotate it 120 degrees and I get the same thing. I still have my reflection symmetries. Likewise, if I squish it in X and Y at the same time, I'm still preserving the symmetries of my EnV center. So then there's types of interactions that do not preserve, that break the symmetry of the EnV center. These are E1 and E2, but okay. So that just gives you some flavor without going too much into the details of group theory, which I had to reteach myself. So this interaction with strain and how it affects these two energy levels is a little bit more complicated. And then just to sort of put this equation into pictorial terms, so without any strain, EX and EY are degenerate. In the presence of this A1 symmetric strain, preserving the symmetry of the EnV center, these get shifted together, and so then one would just see a shift of the zero phonon line. Okay. This E-symmetric strain will split EX and EY. Okay, so that's what happens. And what we want to do is we wanted to very carefully measure all of these 4 coupling parameters. Why? Because, well, first of all, it's fundamental interest, but also for some of these, for instance, cooling proposals, they actually rely on effectively on these lambda 3 and lambda 4, which are more like shear coupling terms, which had not been well characterized before. Okay, so we wanted to make sure that what our cooling strength, for instance, would be. Okay, but it's not so easy to do, partially because of intrinsic strain. But to measure these parameters, we use both. We have the EX and EY, so we can independently monitor those two. We can look at different EnV orientations, and we can also study the photon polarization. So strain also changes the polarization of the emitted photons, which I think is also potentially interesting. Okay, so I've already kind of shown this picture before. We have 2 classes.
I'm actually
yes.
Confused. So the lambda 3, lambda 4 sort of couplings, they were coupling to shear strains.
Yeah,
whereas
so you can see.
The lambda 1, lambda 2, they were compressional, essentially. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's specific compressions.
Yeah,
yes. Yeah. Right.
So, is it not true? But I thought it's not true that if I, instead of using EXEY, if I actually commit some angle maybe even z. Can I not interconvert some combination of lambda 3 and lambda 4? I guess, okay, you've learned the group theory. So there's no way to couple into the EXEY if you use a different combination of external fields. These are
just labeling the states. So I think that's because you're saying coming in at different angles.
So you have six excited states.
So
are you saying, is the statement that without lambda 3 and lambda 4, just with lambda 1 and lambda 2,
yes.
you don't split any
you
of
don't
those
split
six
EX
excited
EY.
States?
No, you you do a little bit, but right now we're just focusing on these two because those, in terms of just needing to characterize what the strain coupling is, those were enough. So we could have looked at the other states, but those couple the different polarizations of photons and it gets a little more. Okay, so I already sort of talked about this when talking about the ground state, but there's two different classes of NV samples that feel different strain under this sort of simple flexural mode. So if one writes the strain tensor in the cantilever's coordinate system and under just under this pure bending, okay, one gets this strain tensor where the nu is the Poisson ratio. So for the green NVs, this is the strain in the NV's axis. This is the strain in the NV's axis for the red guys. Okay, so just to show you that we can utilize those two different orientations to extract out the various strain coupling parameters. Another thing that we did, initially I showed you these Batman-like structures, these Lorentzians modulated by sinusoidal strain modulation, but we can be a little bit more careful, and we can, if we drive the cantilever, we can only measure the NV center, say, for a short amount of time at the maximum displacement of the cantilever in one direction and in the other direction. So effectively, what we call is a stroboscopic measurement, where we are effectively doing a DC measurement. We're only measuring the photons emitted, say, when the cantilever's here or when it's here. And by doing that, you can see we see nice narrow lines that you no longer have this modulation. That helps us. That gives us better fit. Okay, so, but again, without going into too many details of all the what we did, effectively, we constructed a quantity that only depends on lambda 1 and lambda 2, okay? It's some combination of looking at how EX and EY change. And with that, we see that as a function of strain, we've constructed this quantity. We look at six different NVs, I think, in this case. Yeah, six different NVs. And you can see that they all sort of exhibit the same behavior. And from that, we can extract lambda 1 and lambda 2 with pretty good precision. OK. But then there's this, but we need lambda 3 and lambda 4. Those are a little bit more complicated because there is intrinsic strain. And maybe I will just briefly say that I wrote initially the energies of the EX and EY states where this was my applied strain. But there's also some intrinsic strain in the diamond crystal, and that's what I'm calling VE1 and VE2. And so how these energy levels move in response to strain depends on the intrinsic strain that was already there. Okay, so we need to know what the intrinsic strain was in order to extract lambda 3 and lambda 4, because they add in quadrature with the intrinsic strain. So how do we measure intrinsic strain? And we sort of scratched our head for a while. The problem is you can't use a lot of different NVs because they all have different intrinsic strains. So how are we going to measure lambda 3 and lambda 4? It turns out that the polarization of the photons emitted depends on intrinsic strain. Okay, so the NV center, we know it has a z-axis that's set by the NV axis, but its x and y are kind of not set by anything except for strain. Okay, so intrinsic strain basically sets your x and your y-axis in the NV center. And so we could fit, these are polar plots where you measure the polarization of the emitted photons. For the EX and the EY state, we can fit those. It turns out that this rotation is related to the intrinsic strain, where E2 and E1 are E2 and E1 symmetric strains. But okay. And then in addition, we know, okay, but this doesn't give us VE2 and VE1, it just gives us the ratio, but we know that the splitting between these has this form. So together, by measuring both the intrinsic splitting and the polarization, we can extract out VE1 and VE2. Okay, so long-winded story. We extract that for each NV, then we can get lambda 3 and lambda 4. This just shows we looked at a bunch of different NVs. Our data fits very well with our fits, and now we have our full four strain coupling parameters.
These are a bunch of different NVs, but with the same, there were four different orientations.
These are a bunch of different NVs, right. And these are so different orientations, but the other nice thing is that all of our data from NV to NV, even there's two NVs that are the same orientation, but they have different intrinsic strain, those fit the data very well together once we incorporate, once we measure their intrinsic strain.
The question
strain.
Is, that these four coupling constants, are they in principle different?
No. Oh, nice. From NV to NV, no, they're not. That's what we needed to sort of...
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that the intrinsic strain is very small, but now you actually extracted it. Is it small?
Yeah, I wouldn't... Oh, did I say it was small? I mean, it's... I guess... Maybe I shouldn't have. I probably shouldn't have said it was small if I didn't.
Never mind. But.
I mean, it's not. I mean, you can see it's actually, you know, on the order here. If you're just looking at splitting, it's on the order of 5 gigahertz. So, sorry if I said it was small.
And that one was not. That was 2 per strain. The constants. Which are on the next slide? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's.
But this doesn't have to do with intrinsic strain. This is just, you know,
I'm just trying to compare in some situation.
Yeah. No, I'd say, yeah, sorry if I said it's small. It's not small. First of all, the splitting shows you already that it's sizable. More importantly, if you look at two different NV centers, another one can be 100 gigahertz. That line will be 100 gigahertz off. So the intrinsic sort of, you know, in this case, maybe more the A-type strain can also be quite large.
So, should I think of intrinsic strain as compared to a lattice without an NV?
It's not a self-induced strain. It's because then it would be the same for every NV, right?
Yeah.
But it's more like, okay, maybe this NV has a local vacancy 3 lattice sites away, and the other guy has a nitrogen that's maybe 4 lattice sites away, or there's some other. I mean, we really don't know. Sorry?
The other centers as well.
Right, other centers, right. There's lots of things that could potentially happen. Or you're
going to
surface.
That's what suggests that this intrinsic strain should be, you know, broadly distributed among different things. I'm confused.
Right, it probably, I mean, we haven't done a systematic study of intrinsic strain on every NV, but basically it's pretty random. Every NV that we look at, we always have to sort of find
EX. The same, but the strain is...
The coupling is the same, but the value of the intrinsic strain is different.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, I guess I'll try to focus on two more things and not so much on the rest. In terms of, let's say, okay, so given that we've measured lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, lambda 4, what are the prospects of using the NV center for cooling the mechanical resonator to its quantum ground state? Short story is, Peter Rauble has proposed two different schemes. One is a sort of simple off-resonant cooling where you drive the system with a laser that's slightly detuned from the transition by a mechanical quanta, okay? And so if you drive at a sort of lower energy, then one can get cooling. The other scheme actually utilizes the EX and the EY state for what's called resonant cooling. This has some advantages, actually many advantages. So this is what we're trying to do. By driving, let's say, just the EX state, matching the separation between the EX and EY to your mechanical resonator, one can also get cooling that way. This is, a more powerful cooling technique and also has some other advantages. But the point is that with our, and actually these are quite conservative parameters, we should be able to get to the down to the ground state. That's our upshot. We need to make higher frequency resonators, so we're doing that right now. So this, I've shown you these very simple flexural mode resonators, okay? But one can engineer sort of, and I think you guys are sort of probably familiar with photonic crystals, where one generates a local photonic mode by structuring a beam. In this case, you can make a local phononic mode. This has two advantages. One is that it's pretty easy to get high frequency modes, which is beneficial as well as the fact that you can make this a very confined mode, which does not talk so much to the clamping points, and therefore its mechanical quality factors can be quite a bit higher. So we're now making these types of structures in the lab. These are just simulations, and then we think, again, with these, in this case, 500 megahertz resonator at 4 Kelvin with 100,000 Q, we should be able to get, again, to the ground state. Okay, so I've talked about what are the challenges for using NV centers. They're all different. You know, this line could be totally in a different place for another NV. Furthermore, this line width is quite broad. Okay, that's a big problem. Indistinguishability of NVs due to local strain. Every NV is somewhere else. Also, how do you position NVs where you want them? At this point, I won't talk about this, but I'll say that we can now do this well. But let me just show the strain tuning. So if we have NV1, let's say we measure one NV, and we see that its EX and EY transitions lie here. We measure NV number two, its EX and EY transitions are a little bit off. Okay, and so here, this shows you one of these stroboscopic measurements for increasing amplitude of drive. And for some amplitude of drive, we can match the EX and EY very well from one to the other. Okay, so that's nice. And as I said, if you want indistinguishable photons, you also want the polarization states to be indistinguishable. But that depends on the intrinsic strain. So we can, let's say we've taken one NV, we've measured its polarization plot. We see that it is what it is, whatever the intrinsic strain dictates that it is. We look at another NV, and this one has a slightly different polarization. Okay. So what we can do is we can drive this NV1 with a 3-nanometer deflection to exactly match the polarization states, and we can do this for another NV that initially had a slightly different polarization character. We can drive this one, we have to drive a little bit harder to match NV1 to NV3, but we can match NVs to each other just by straining the crystal. So that's, I think, pretty exciting. We've also suppressed spectral diffusion and formed local NVs, but in summary, I've told you that we've coupled both the ground state and the excited state to strain. We've been able to control both the energy of the photons and the polarization of the emitted photons via strain. And then I didn't really talk so much about this, but we've made some sort of materials advancements towards incorporating NVs into maybe a photonic or phononic network. So thank you.
We had a lot of questions.
Is there a static dipole moment either in ground or in an excited state?
Yes, so there is, there is a, obviously there's a magnetic dipole moment, there's an electric.
Electric dipole moment, static,
yes.
Electric dipole moment.
In the ground state. Yes.
Oh, in the and what about
and there's a trans-
state? Are they different? I ask just because.
Yes, they are different. Yeah, because with the optical, the transition dipole moment lies perpendicular to the NV axis, whereas the sort of.
Not the optical transition.
Okay.
Static dipole moment in the ground state and the excited state. You see, in this case,
yeah,
so it's related with the energies.
Right, so
electric
fields, yes. Yes, so yes, there is. And the dipole moment lies along the NV quantization axis. And yes, in both the ground and the excited state. They're different magnitudes, definitely. It's much larger. It's much larger in the excited state. Right, sorry, I was in the transition, there is a transition dipole moment, and that lies perpendicular to that axis, but that's a different story. Fine, okay. But yes.
There is no burning question then. Thank you.